The following podcast is a production of Mosaic in Whittier, California, a community of faith, hope, and love. For more information about Mosaic gatherings and events, please visit mosaic.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Mosaic Whittier. Today we're actually starting a new series called Dear Los Angeles. And in the New Testament, there was many of the epistles were written to cities. And what we're doing is kind of picking up on that theme. And what if it was written to us, to Los Angeles? And today, the first topic in the 4 weeks, we're going to have a guest speaker each week. And today is on creativity. And the gentleman that joins us today is a writer. He's one of the site pastors at Mosaic Mayan. He's also a professor at both Pepperdine and Golden Gate Seminary. So please give a warm welcome to Jason.
So we're doing the series, Dear L.A., and, you know, I mean, wondering what God would say to Los Angeles. There's probably a lot of different opinions about that. If you're not from L.A., like I'm from Kansas City, anybody from the Midwest, anybody transplants, a few people? No? Anyone? Bueller? You are. Awesome. So this will be funny for you. I mean, when I chose to quit my job and move to Los Angeles, all my friends thought I was crazy, you know, because to them, it was like la-la land. You know, that's like where all those people go who like eat sushi and do yoga and, you know, that kind of a thing. And, you know, if you feel like that's kind of the LA vibe, I don't do yoga. So we can, you know, connect on that level if you don't do yoga. But there's kind of like this perception of LA that sometimes it's like Sodom and Gomorrah. And that if God were to say something to Los Angeles, that he would be really angry and he would say really horrible things. But those of us who live here in LA know better. And we know that God loves the city, and that if he were to say something to this city, it would be full of hope and compassion. And so that's kind of where we want to pick up today. Does anybody write letters anymore? Yeah, a few people do. Yeah, most of us. Raise your hand if like letters just aren't really your thing anymore. Kind of don't do that anymore. Yeah, okay, yeah. And because we've got email, we've got text messaging, Skype, AIM. You know, there's like a bazillion different ways to communicate. Really, the only people who write letters or write anything down anymore is like if like a birthday card or like that kind of a thing. Then you go to Hallmark, which they wrote the letter, and then you write a note on it and then send it. You know, kind of a thing. But the people who send me letters even today are my grandparents. Do you ever get those? The grandparent, if they're still alive, like the grandparent letters, or like maybe your parents. And those, you know, like when I get a card, like a Hallmark card, you know, I'll open it up, then I'll do the flicks, you know, to see if there's any money in it, and then I'll throw it away. That's kind of thing. But when my grandparents write a letter, it's different, isn't it? Like when your grandparents write you something, you open it up and they fold. You can just picture how much care they put into folding it, you know. And they're because of their age, their handwriting isn't as good as it used to be, and it just kind of reveals the love and the frailty that went into that whole process for them. And you can imagine them sitting down and trying really hard to say something funny, you know, or to say something caring or kind, or to encourage you, or to make fun of their grandma, or like whatever they're doing, you know. And so when you get those letters, you hold them because they're evidence of love. And kind of like what Corey was saying, most of the New Testament were letters written to groups of people in respective cities who were trying to serve that city. And it's amazing to me that the voices that shaped the Western world came from letters. And so as we kind of spend the next couple weeks on this series, just asking the question, like what or how can these letters shape us even today? That's kind of what we're going to process. So did everybody have a good 4th of July? For the most part, yeah. Anybody do the beach thing? Apparently that's like a big LA thing to do, is the beach thing. I've been here for 5 years. I've never once spent a 4th of July at the beach. No, is it bad? No, it's like the warning, don't do it. It's like going to Disneyland, you know, like everyone, middle class people from all over the world make their Mecca trip to Disneyland. And then they're miserable the whole day because they spent thousands of dollars on plane tickets and everything to get to Disneyland. And they're there for one day and they gotta like stress themselves out. And I have an annual pass now. You know, so I like going just to watch people from Ohio be miserable. And it sounds kind of like that's the way it is with the beach. You know, it's just like you go there, you do your thing, and then you never have to do it ever again. But my mom was born on the 4th of July, which is kind of fun. So her and Tom Cruise, both born on the 4th of July. And so my dad had like added pressure. You know, you just can't do like a normal thing if your mom's born or anybody in your family is born on the 4th of July. So you had to do something special. So growing up, the 4th of July was always a really special thing for us, especially like in the 5-year increments, you know, like 35, 40, 45 kind of a thing. So some of the things that we did, we rented a hot air balloon and rode the hot air balloon all over the city and watched the fireworks. Another one, we chartered a private plane, and because you know, 5 years to save up for this kind of stuff. You know, we would fly over like Royal Stadium and Arrowhead and like fly over and watch all the fireworks. My favorite one was, this is before 9/11, we went to Washington, D.C., and we watched the D.C. fireworks from the lawn of the Pentagon, which was unbelievable. Like, it doesn't matter. Even if Osama bin Laden would have been there, he would have been like, my country tis a thee. Like, it's this thing. It's just like this power. It's all amazing, you know. And, you know, patriotism is kind of a weird thing these days, just because, you know, the more globalized we become, the more we realize that we don't always make good choices and this kind of thing. And as America kind of fumbles our way into the future, trying to do the best that we can sometimes, it's kind of weird. But for me growing up, and my mom is like passionate about Independence Day, and it was just impressed on me from a very young age that something special happened a couple hundred years ago. Were a group of people, white men, but we have to go there. Like a group of, you know, like people who didn't want to pay taxes, tried to create something different. You know, like they tried to, all the mixed motives, all of the, you know, elitism and everything aside, it was a group of people who said, we wonder if we can create a world that looks like this, something that had never been done before. And it's kind of there that we intersect this conversation about creativity. You know, because a lot of us, when we think of creativity, most people, when they think of creativity, what do they think of? Art, right? Of course. And if we were talking about Los Angeles and creativity, that makes total sense, right? I mean, creativity, as far as the arts, is our major export. You know, I mean, we make films, we make music, even like technology. A lot of, I mean, as far as Southern California is concerned, we really are like the capital of the Pacific Rim. And as we move into the future, it's no longer going to be the Far East. It's actually going to be the Near East. And geopolitics is going to shift away from the West and towards the East with Japan and India and China. And Los Angeles is actually strategically placed in this rim for maximum influence. But I don't want to be myopic this morning. I don't want to just focus on the arts because creativity is actually a lot broader than that. And I don't know if you've ever heard of it. There's a book out right now. It's called The Element. And it's written by a guy named Sir Ken Robinson. And he used to be the Minister of Education for Great Britain, and now he travels around. He's an expert on human creativity. And if you listen to him or talk to him, he'll talk about how if you get like a room full of kindergartners and you say, raise your hands if you're creative, everybody raises their hands. You know, like kindergartners, you can say anything, they raise their hands, right? And then if you ask a group of eighth graders, you know, how many of you are creative, and a lot of them will raise their hands, you know, a few less. And then if you ask high school students, how many of you are creative? As they're graduating as seniors, how many of you are creative? Almost nobody raises their hands. And what Ken Robinson observes is that you don't become creative. Like, creativity is not something you do as you get older. It's something you're born with, and then you are educated out of it. Which, to me, is a tragic story. And he comes from the side of education, and I get to play in kind of a lot of different worlds, and education is one of them. And having been in spiritual communities for a long time, I've discovered that education isn't the only environment that knocks creativity out of people. And actually, religious environments do too. And I used to work with troubled kids in Kansas City, and I had this story a lot, but I'll tell this one. There was a girl named Elise, and she was sassy, funny, totally disrespectful to authority, and so you loved her immediately. You know, just one of those people, even though she was 17, she intimidated you, you know, because she just like saw right through you. You know, when I'm like 21 years old, I'm trying to figure out what does it mean to invest in people, and she just knew I didn't know what I was doing at all. And so this was Elise, and she was great. And with her sassiness and with her rambunctiousness, she came from a really troubled home, and she had a really troubled life. You know, she just made a lot of destructive choices, and eventually those kind of in cycles, those choices would catch up with her, and so she would find herself in my office, and we'd be talking, and she'd be crying, and I had no idea what to do, what to say, you know, and so God has played kind of a formative role in my life, and so I was trying to help, and I would kind of like bring, you know, like God up, right? And as soon as I did, she would like freak out. She would get really uncomfortable, and then I would get uncomfortable, making her uncomfortable. And so then we're like uncomfortable together, and we're just kind of like this cyclical discomfort thing. And as we talk more about it and kind of massage it a little bit, she'd finally be like, Jason, I can't give my life to God. Now, I've been doing this for a long time. I hear that a lot. And I was like, well, you know, talk to me about why. Like, let's process this a little bit. And she said what I've heard high school students and beyond say for over 10 years now, probably what I would have said when I was 18 or 17 as well. She said, I can't give my life to God because if I do, he's going to make me a nun. Right? You know what I'm talking about? Like this idea that like if I give like the ultimate expression of like love to God is if you become a nun. And to a 17-year-old girl, the only thing nuns are known for are what they can't do. Think about it. Okay? There's only one thing they really want to do, and nuns don't get to do that. Right? And so for her, she defined spiritual affection. She defined giving herself to God, quote unquote, as defined by what she can't do, which at first confused me. But the more I spend time with normal people, the more it really begins to make sense. And that's kind of where we want to intersect the scriptures for today. So if you open up your copy of the scriptures, there's a letter written by a dude named Paul to a group of people in the city of Ephesus. And so for whatever reason, we call it the book of Ephesians, even though it's a letter. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at chapter 4 and starting in verse, I believe, 22. So what I want you to do is I want you to listen for Elise's perspective. Listen for her perspective as you're reading this passage. Here we go. Put off your old self, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful desires, and be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and put on the new self created after the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. 25, big one. Having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak truth to his neighbor, for we are members of one another. 26, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and give no opportunity to the devil. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as good for building others up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you. Now, can you see kind of where her perspective might come from? As she hears that, there's a lot of don'ts in there. Well, let's just be honest, right? Don't steal. You know, get rid of your deceitful desires. Don't let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth. Don't grieve the Holy Spirit. Like, there's this kind of this litany of and what you need to understand is most of us are wired to hear the don'ts. Even just psychologically. Like if you look at psychology, psychology is a study of what's wrong with you. Right? And then if you learn psychology, like I was a psych major or a minor, and I took abnormal psych in college, which is a lot of fun. Because all it is talking about how messed up we are. For like and really fanatical and really weird ways. Ways that we don't talk about at parties. You know, that's kind of how it worked. And that's kind of the study, and that's how it works. And even like when you were a kid, if you came home when you had all A's and one D, what did your parents focus on? Did they cheer for you that you got four A's? No, what did they say? What's with the D? You know? Or even for those of you who have jobs in this economy, if you go in for a performance review, right, and you spend 5 minutes talking about what you did great, and then you spend 45 minutes talking about what? Areas of improvement, right? Which is code for what you're bad at. And that's what we talk about. You know, and after a while, this becomes a part of our psyche. It becomes a part of our soul. Like, we're kind of wired to focus on the negative. Even if I were to ask a lot of you, like, tell me about your spiritual life. I do this a lot. And the instinctively, the things that come to our minds are the things that we're not doing or the things that we are doing that we shouldn't be, right? So how's your life with God going? Well, I'm not praying enough. I'm not reading the Bible enough, you know, or I smoked, drank, cussed, you know, had sex, did, you know, whatever. Like this is a whole, like it's like the big five. And that becomes the definition of spiritual maturity. And so when you introduce Elise to the God of the don'ts, that becomes really terrifying for her. And religion becomes like a straitjacket to hold her in. Has anyone ever felt that way? And the process is trying to live your life. And for her, because, and she understands that her desires aren't always healthy, but her desires are all she has. So to say, come to God and give up your desires is a terrifying thought. One that even I think kind of creeps into our own minds, not just Elise's. You know, and then we have to like figure out how are we going to live this life? Because we know that it's good to be with God, but sometimes being with God isn't all that good. And even like the word good is kind of an interesting word, right? Like even when you're a little kid, if your mom, some of your moms are in here, if your mom told you to be good, was she telling you to do something or not do something? Not do something, right? Jason, don't kick the hamster. Jason, don't hit your sister. Jason, you know, be good. Never in the history of the world has a child gone to his mother and said, Mom, I'm bored. I mean, that happens all the time. But never has the response been, well, honey, be good. No, that doesn't work. That's why I'm bored. I'm bored because I was being good. I need you to give me permission to do something. And what happens is good becomes the absence of evil rather than the opposite of evil. Does that make sense? And it's very seductive, and it starts to shape our spiritual lives, where to be good is to stop doing things, which is taking the script. I mean, that's a biblical idea, except it's only half of the biblical idea. So that's a profound truth. It's only just half true. Because if you look at the text, it's not just a litany of don'ts, is it? There actually is some beautiful ideas nestled in the text between the don'ts that could be the secret to us living an inspiring life. And that's kind of the whole point, is in our souls, if we're wired to automatically see the don'ts, that means we're almost like, not anemic, but our proactive muscles are almost atrophied. And we're not able to see the positive, because good has a texture to it. Good has a substance to it. Like even when you think about food, you can think about bad food, you know, like maybe Wendy's or something, or at least food that's bad for you. But then you can think about good food, like Chick-fil-A, right? Or you think about good dessert. Like my favorite dessert is French silk pie. And when I think about it, like I start to salivate, you know, because it's this whipped chocolate with the fluffy white cream floating on top with nice, you know, chocolate shavings nestled. And I mean, it's just this, oh, it's amazing, right? That's I can taste that. I can see that. But sometimes, especially in spiritual communities, the only thing we can taste are the things that are wrong. And that's why I love the scriptures, is because they don't just show us what's destructive. They actually entice us towards what's good, what's beautiful, what's healthy. Now, the problem with that is that what's good, what's proactive, is all about risk. It always involves risk. Doing anything good, doing anything creative, doing anything positive in the world always involves risk, and consequently, it's terrifying, you know? Because by definition of risk is when you do something that you don't know how it's going to turn out. And most people actually have a high level of risk aversion. And so instead of managing their lives, how many of you actually discover that life is managing you? And it's not our fault. I mean, after a while, it's just the normal everyday grind begins to kind of manage us rather than us taking the creative destinies of our own lives. And so it's in that moment when we start to siphon it off. And even if we do get rid of the bad, we're still kind of in this mucky middle called average. And it's in that moment, this average moment, that the scriptures speak to us. And God says, you don't have to live like this. And he says things like, don't steal, but get a job, which is great in this economy. And then why did he get a job? So that you can give to those who have need. Like that's what the passage says. So it's not just stop stealing. It's stop stealing and become a philanthropist. Does that make sense? So even when it says, let no unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, it doesn't stop there. It says, let no unwholesome talk come out of your mouths. Then it says, but only what is helpful for building other people up. And it doesn't even stop there. It says even further, so then it may benefit those who are around you. So don't just become a person who complains or a person who pulls people down. And don't just become a positive person, but actually create cultures where everybody discovers their distinct value to God. You see what happens? And it begins to shift. And don't just rid yourself of all clamor and malice and bitterness, but become full of compassion and joy and happiness. But those things are actually kind of scary. It's actually kind of scary to be happy. Even like a psychologist studied depression, it takes risk to be happy, because as soon as you're happy, you have something to lose. As long as you're unhappy, you don't have anything to lose. You know, it's even like when you go see a movie and you lower your standards, well, so you won't be disappointed, right? If you go in expecting a lot from a George Lucas movie, you're going to leave disappointed, you know, or better, a Michael Bay movie, okay? If you go in expecting an Academy Award winner from Michael Bay's Transformers, you're going to be walking out disappointed in explosions and Megan Fox. That's just the way it works. And so that's kind of how we begin to manage our lives, not just in film, but managing our lives all the time. Is we just kind of like lower the standards just a little bit because it's too painful to be disappointed. And God says, no, you have to have courage, you have to take risks, you have to actually anticipate creating beauty in the world. So this is hard, and so I've been trying to figure out this in my own life. How do we, like, do this? Like, how as a community do we do this? So I teach at Pepperdine, and so I had an idea to get a group of college students together, and we're going to do a little thing called risk groups. Okay, so I don't know if you've ever worked with college students before, but getting college students to do anything is kind of like trying to herd cats. Like, it's just... It's not, you know, I mean, it's kind of, and the more you try, the more they just, like, lick their legs and, like, walk off. I mean, it's just not gonna happen for me. So I already had lowered my expectations, right, because that's what we do. So I was like, you know what, let's get a few students in a room and let's see what happens. And then throughout the day, I wasn't surprised, but throughout the day, I got the texts. Never a phone call. Never calls you saying they can't make it. They always email you or text you, right? So I'm getting the texts leading up to it, and so-and-so can't come, and I'm not coming. I got, you know, I'm going on this date, so I got to play Xbox or whatever. I'm busy, all right? So that's kind of the conversation. And so I get discouraged, but I'm trying not to get discouraged. And I'm walking up to this dorm room because that's where we're going to have it. And as I turn the corner, I hear, like, it's even worse than I thought. Like, I hear, like, a party, right? And I'm like, great. There's a party next door. No one's going to want to go and, like, take risks. Everyone's going to go to this stupid party. And then I walk up to the door where I'm supposed to be, and I realize that the party is there. And there's, like, 25, 30 students there, and they are there for what I wanted to do. And I was, like, I was shocked. And for the next 4 weeks, we had the adventure of our lives. And it was kind of like Fight Club. And so you meet once a week for 4 weeks, and everybody has to take a risk. So in Fight Club, everyone has to fight. And, you know, risk group, everyone has to take a risk. And the risk has to be something positive. It has to be something proactive. So, like, if you've got a girlfriend and she treats you, you know, poorly, like, a risk isn't to not treat her poorly back. That's not a risk. That's just not doing anything. You actually have to do, you have to go buy her a flower or something. Like, you have to do something proactive. And two things happened in those 4 weeks. The first was we discovered how hard it was to think like that. It was really hard for people. And these are college students. Pepperdine's a top 50 school. They had a hard time thinking about what positive, creative risk they were going to take in the world that week. And so it was like flexing these muscles really for the first time, right? Because they're in an environment where everything is chosen for them. They pick a major, which they freak out about for 8 months, and pick a major, and then everything else is created for them. So they never really have to express their volition. So that was the first thing. The second thing was once they got the hang of it, the most amazing things started to happen. So one guy, his father had been in prison for a few years, and his mom would not let him talk to him. And so his risk was to, and he kind of didn't want to because he's embarrassed and ashamed and everything. So his risk was to go to the prison and talk to his father for the first time in like 5 years. Another one, there's this girl who, her dream is to be an Olympic trainer, which is just a pipe dream. I mean, there aren't a lot of Olympic trainers, or even fewer Olympic trainers as there are Olympic athletes. So, I mean, you see, that's how it works. And I said her risk was to talk to her coach and tell her coach her dream. And this is, it's just embarrassing, you know? I mean, to go up to your professor and say, I want to win an Academy Award someday, it's like, great, sit down. You know, stop disrupting class. I mean, that's kind of how it works. So she goes up to her coach and she's like, you know, I want to be an Olympic trainer someday. And she got the response that she thought, you know, he's like, it's really hard, you know, and she's like, I know. And he's like, you'd have to go to Colorado Springs for like the Olympic training thing. She's like, I know. And he's like, you'd have to talk to, Cindy, who's like the head of that whole thing. And she's like, I know. And he's like, she's my friend. And she goes, what? And in that meeting, he picks the phone up and says, Cindy, hi, how's it going? Yeah, how's Colorado? Is it dry up there? Nice, you know, this whole thing. Hey, I got my friend Jennifer here. She's got a lot of talent. I really believe in her. I think she should be an intern for you this summer in Colorado Springs. Would that be possible? Yeah, she's right here. Hands her the phone. And she's going to Colorado Springs. You know what I'm talking about? Like that, and that, this stuff happened all the time. And we had like, that's like the big stuff. And we had little stupid things like a guy writing a love song for a girl, you know, who was like way out of his league. It's this amazing, amazing, amazing stuff. And so my risk was I wanted to write a screenplay. And I don't know how many people have ever tried to write a screenplay or write anything like that before. A few people, yeah, it's hard, right? And this is the thing, it's way harder than other people think. So for me to like sit down, I thought, and that was me. I was the person who thought it would be like easy because I like to write. You know, and so I sat down and I tried to like pump out a 120-page screenplay like in an afternoon, you know, and I get like half a page in with no dialogue and there's no story. I didn't realize you had to start with a story, you know, this kind of stuff. And it's just going horrible for me. So my risk was to talk to a friend of mine who has made several short films, has traveled all over the world doing documentaries, like a really gifted guy. So I sat down with him and I was like, hey, you know, kind of want to write, you know, experiment with this. I want to be a better storyteller, and I want to try to use screenplay as a medium for that. And he, you know, I told him, he goes, well, what have you done? I'm like, well, I got a half page of 140-page screenplay. And he just laughed. You know, he's like, okay. Here's what you do. Take three ideas that you have and just write a one-page screenplay of each, and then call me in 2 weeks. That's it. Simple, right? Easy. So I did that, and one of those one-page things just naturally, you probably understand how this works, naturally turned into like a five-page screenplay. And that's not like rocket science or anything, but 5 pages is a short. Like that's a, you know, that's a Pixar short, that's a whatever, you know, if you can get the funding for it. So I was having a ball, I was feeling really good, and then a few weeks later I was at this party, and I met this guy named Brian, and we had some mutual friends, and so he was asking me, so what are you doing outside of your work? Like, tell me something like a hobby of yours. And I actually don't have hobbies, so, because I love my work, but this was kind of something that I had. So I was like, well, I kind of have this like 5-page screenplay thing. He goes, really, tell me what it's about. So I tell him the story, and when I got done, he goes, without blinking, he goes, do you want to make that? I was like, what? I said, who are you? He says, my name is Brian, and you know, your friends told me, you know, that I should meet you. And what he does is he's a producer, and he produces AFI thesis films. So he's not like Steven Spielberg or anything, but like what he does is when AFI students, you know, do their thesis film, they hire him to produce it. So he's got a lot of production under his belt, really talented guy. And I'm like, what? And then we got together at the Grove to talk about it, and it was kind of like two dogs like sniffing each other's butts. Because we didn't really know, like, he didn't know me, I didn't know him, you know, it's kind of like, why are you, like, I right off from the bat, I was like, I can't pay you, you know, like, if this is like a gig for you, because like, the, you know, the economy's in the toilet, like, I can't help you. And he's like, no, it's not about that, like, we'll do everything on the down low, it's not a big deal. And he goes, but here's the thing, Jason, I'll only produce your film if you direct it. I was like, what? I've never been on a set before. The only thing I know the directors do is this. And that's because I've seen pictures of, like, you know, Michael Mann doing this, you know, or like because I watched like a DVD special feature thing and I saw that's what, you know, that's what they do. And they talk to the actors. They talk to the actors and they do this. That's all I know. You know, so the right choice is to say, no, I can't direct. That's not what I do. So I chose to direct, right? I mean, that's just, what else are you going to do? And I tell you, I kid you not. The night before, it was, we had to cram everything into one day. It was like a 14-hour shoot. And we had my editor is the editor for the new movie coming out by the director who did Virtuosity with Denzel Washington in the 90s. My AD was my friend who originally got me the script, like challenged me or whatever. My staff was like out of control. And we worked it up. If we would have like financed the film, it would have cost probably like $30,000 to $40,000 to make. And we did it for $300. All because I asked my friend, hey, can you help me write a one-page script? And I just wonder, even in this room, like what are the untapped dreams that could come out of our lives if we would just take a small risk? You'll notice in the scriptures, like it doesn't say get a job so that you can like cure world hunger. It says get a job so that you can give away some. And I can't help but think that the way that he's going to help you end world hunger is by starting with what you got. And what I had was a half page of dialogue, you know? And all of us have at least a half page of dialogue. And if we would just take the risk to get it out there, what could happen with it? And that is the essence of the creative act. It's where you look at the blank page. It's when you look at the, you know, the empty canvas, or even when you look at a new marriage or the marriage you got, and you don't know what the future holds, and you look at your job or the job that you don't have or the job that you want, and you look into this unknown future. And you take a small, just a simple small risk in a direction, a risk of vulnerability, a risk of love, a risk of creativity, and then to see what God does with it. My favorite part of the story, when I met Brian, one of the reasons why he was nervous to meet me is because he's an atheist Jew. I mean, that's his background. You know, he's just, he would say, and it'd be true, he's an agnostic, you know? And so atheist too harsh for him. And but he, you know, he's curious and he's open. He's not like a, you know, bigot or anything. I'm the bigot, right? So I mean, he was trying to figure that out. And so we were nervous to work together, but it was really beautiful as like the karma, we became friends as this thing happened, you know. And as he got to meet more people and he got sucked into my excitement for what we were doing, I got to introduce him to people like you. And through that, let's see, like a month ago, I took another risk and I just asked him about his spiritual journey. Just like, what's your life with God like? And I told a story about a friend of mine who I accidentally saw his first kiss. Has anyone ever, probably no one else has ever had that experience, where you accidentally see one of your friend's first kisses. It was like, I rounded the corner, it was like, whoa, you know, kind of a thing. But they didn't see me. And so there's this guy who's big and tall and lanky like me and kind of funny looking, and he's kissing this girl who's like way out of his league. And it was like the fairy tale thing, you know, it was like the bing, you know, kind of a thing. It was awesome, right? And then the cutest thing after that, she went into her dorm room, this is in college, and he literally skipped back to his dorm room, right? And I got to see the whole thing. A little voyeuristic, but like it was okay. Right? And I was talking to Brian. I was like, have you ever had that moment when, you know, when you let God into your life and then you sent him skipping home? Because that's, I mean, that's how he feels whenever he gets to interact with somebody in a new and a fresh way. And I was expecting him to say no. You know, I mean, he'd been around Mosaic for a while. He'd been coming to the club and we'd had conversations about God before, and the whole thing made him very nervous. And so I asked him, you know, have you had that moment? And he goes, oh, I had that like a month ago. I was like, what? And he goes, yeah. I go, why didn't you tell me? And he's so new at all of this stuff. Like he doesn't have a frame of reference. He's just trying to search for what he's trying to believe, you know? And he goes, I didn't know I was supposed to tell anybody. I was like, oh, I'd love to be your friend through that. And so this month, my friend Brian is gonna decide to follow Jesus and get baptized, which is really beautiful. And I can't help but think that the silly 5-minute short that I shot wasn't really about the 5-minute short. See, God will use your creativity. God will use your excitement. God will use your passion. God will use the small, seemingly insignificant risks in your life to draw people who are searching for him closer to you. And when we begin to live lives of creativity, we actually become magnetic to people who are searching for life. And so it doesn't become us managing life or life managing us. It becomes us creating life and life being created in our friends. You know, I asked Brian, like, what has this whole experience been like for you? And again, this is like, he's a 32-year-old balding producer, you know, agnostic with a Jewish background. He goes, my life with God is like falling in love for the first time. It's this beautiful thing, and he doesn't know how to explain it, and he doesn't know how to put words to it, but God's not the only one skipping home in their relationship. And that is the essence of creativity, because love is the ultimate creative act. And I can't help but think that if God were to say something to Los Angeles, he would say, you tell amazing stories. Like the canvas of Los Angeles and what you export to the world, from Slumdog Millionaire to Shawshank Redemption, you tell stories that captivate the entire planet. Now my dream for you is that it wouldn't be just your art that captivates people, that would actually become your lives. That out of the context of sacrifice and love and risk, the world would know Los Angeles, not just because of the stories we tell, but because of the stories that we live. And I know in this room, there are buried dreams. Creativity is like just right underneath the surface. And if we would just take a small risk, God would begin to unearth things that we would never think that we could do. So I mentioned Ken Robinson at the beginning. And I got to meet him, which is kind of cool, kind of serendipitously. He lives in L.A. He moved from Great Britain to L.A. And so we got to spend a few minutes together. And I asked him, because he's an expert on creativity and he works with education, I said, is there anything other than like the educational system that needs to be rewired to help unleash people's creativity? Like, have you met any other kind of company or any other organization that specializes in unleashing human creativity and potential? And he looked at me, this expert in creativity who travels the world doing this for a living. He looked at me and he goes, I have not found anything designed to unleash human creativity and potential. And if you know me, most of you don't, but if you know me, if you ask me what I do, I don't say I work at a church, because most people, when they think of a church, they think of stained glass windows, pews, a preacher who makes you feel like you're going to hell. Like that's kind of like church. I say that I work for a nonprofit that specializes in unleashing human creativity and potential. because that's what I believe the church is made to do, which is why Mosaic is so important, which is why you are so important. Like, you're actually important and necessary to Whittier becoming the culture that it was meant to be. Mosaic is actually necessary, an instrument in helping Los Angeles discover her unearthed or her buried God-given talents and resources. You know, and when we partner together, we're actually necessary in helping the world become a creative force for beauty and talent and character and hope and love and things that Jesus loved to talk about most. And that is Dear Los Angeles. That is a conversation of creativity, and that is a conversation that God has with us today. Let's pray. God, it's hot in here. Well, hopefully perspiration isn't the only thing coming out of us right now. Hopefully there are dreams. There are small risks to be had in our relationships, in our vocation, in our goals. And God, I would love, just give us a spirit of courage, not a spirit of selfishness, not just about our short films or our music or, you know, our craft or our trade, but that we would leverage those things to serve humanity on your behalf. I love you very much, and I'm thankful that you create communities like Mosaic Whittier to be a playground for people's character and their lives, and that people would come from all over the globe to find the creativity that you have for him within these walls. I love you very much. It's in the name of Jesus I pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this production by Mosaic Whittier, a community of faith, hope, and love. For more information about Mosaic gatherings and events, please visit mosaic.org.